Welcome to another episode of the podcast, and thanks for tuning in. My guest this week is Nikolai Morris. Nikolai works in Australian rules football as the head of performance for AFLW at Collingwood AFL Club. She's also the strength and conditioning coach for world champion and Olympic medalist high jumper Nicola Olislagers. Nikolai has over 17 years of experience and has worked with a variety of sporting disciplines. She's also an elite level 3 ASCA coach. For today's show, Nikolai will be going through some of the strength and movement methods that help set up Nicola Olislagers for a oceanic record in high jump, and she'll be talking about their emphasis on gymnastic work, bodyweight strength, as well as multi-surface plyometric training. She'll be talking about both the traditional strength in the program and then the more multilateral bodyweight-oriented elements. We also get into things like swimming and coaching ideas such as athlete autonomy. This was an expansive discussion on the role of strength and coordination. It was great having Nikolai on the show again. Let's get to episode 403. Nick, it's awesome to have you back on the show. I know you've a lot has changed for you recently, like new job and things like that. We were talking right before we pushed record about you as a pole vaulter, because I know that's not your background, and you've been doing that for a few years now. And I'm just curious what you've learned. It's so movement intensive. There's so much going on. What has that event taught you, doing it firsthand as an athletic performance coach?
Yeah, well, first, thanks. I love chatting to you, where we find so much interesting conversation, and our backgrounds kind of have gone from same but different sides. So it's always fascinating having this conversation. But yeah, pole vault, I actually think I had started just before the last time I was on the podcast. And it's been an interesting journey with lots of stop starts because of different moves and trying to find different coaches and COVID lockdowns. And then the joy of being in S&C, traveling internationally a fair bit with my previous teams. So it's not been a consistent run, which I would love, so I could actually compete a little bit higher than I am currently. But it's been a fascinating journey of learning and development. It's such a complex sport and so technical, and like every sport is incredibly technical. But if you don't get the technique even close, you're just going nowhere. And I think one of the cool things working with Nicola Olislagers as well as a high jumper, it's giving me another level of empathy, just looking at that bar and going, oh, it's so high, and just the mental strength needed to overcome that and get in a mindset where you can just go. But at the end of the day, I just think being in that learning space, being in a new sport, developing, trying to work at a process-based goal helps me, one, empathize with my athletes, but two, it allows me to communicate in a better way. So, for example, I'm learning when I get a cue and it's like, oh, just push with your bottom arm or your left arm. Like, I can't. I'm trying everything I'm doing. I'm just trying to push, and all my body wants to do is pull it in, which is, again, part of the reason I'm such an average pole vaulter. But trying to learn different ways of cueing, because it's not going to work for everyone, and working out, okay, which athletes need to be filmed and shown. That's the only way it's going to work for them. Which athletes need to be have a discussion with and work out where they're struggling, what's not connecting for them, what cues resonate for them. And it's just a really good reinforcer for that side. And I also think competing in anything, learning in anything, assists your brain. You want to always be developing and learning. And this is just a fun outlet for me. And it's awesome. I've trained with a lot of masters athletes who are 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 plus that still jump and still want to learn and still get there and put everything into it. And yeah, it's just such a nice environment. Being in a sport like pole vault, where no matter what group I've competed in, everyone is so open and helpful to each other to try and get better. And you see it even from the elite level, that they've got that kind of vibe going, which is, yeah, such a beautiful space to be in.
Yeah, that kind of maybe it reminds me a little bit about like what I've heard about surfers from like Stephen Kotler, like they're like the happiest people. Maybe it's because like the danger, it's extreme, it's kind of in nature, or it is in nature, obviously. I was like, pole vault's like you're outside. But it's almost as if that kind of gnarliness of it, the danger element, the flow state, there's something that connects people, I think, and has like a good vibes, for lack of a better word, because I've always seen that with pole vault as well. I mean, the other events too, I think the throws a lot of times pretty friendly.
100%.
Yeah.
I'm just terrible at that, so I don't do much throwing.
Yeah. It's funny that the empathy, I guess I always ask those questions like, all right, what did you pick up technically or movement sense? But I hadn't thought about it from the empathy perspective. The only experience I've had there is when I work swimming. Me and you are like reverse, because I think you were a swimmer, right? And so I was the furthest thing from a swimmer growing up and doing track, like stiff ankles or ankles that were not bendy for swimming. They were good for jumping. And I remember learning the butterfly stroke, and I could never do the butterfly as a kid. And then the volunteer assistant coach at Cal taught me. And I just remember always hearing, oh, the 200 fly is the hardest event. Oh, you got to swim the 2 fly today and this and that. And I never really thought much about it. And then I remember just like completing a 25 butterfly the first time I did that. I was like, wow, someone has to do this so many more times, you know, like 8 more times. That's tough. Okay, now I have some empathy for you. or like the jokes about the piano, the person who's the piano's on their back for the last 50. I mean, that a race you did? The 200? I mean, I guess every swimmer's got to do it, right? But
yeah, to be fair, and I've had this conversation with one of my best mates a lot of times, I don't think the 200 fly is the hardest event. It hurts, the piano falls, and you can barely move. And gosh, when you are unfit, it's not a fun event. I even did 100 fly, I think, last year and year before, something like that. And the last 25 meters, I could barely get my head out of the water. And the people behind the blocks who knew me were like, were you laughing? It's like, yeah, it was so funny. I was drowning because I'm not fit enough to get my body in the right position. But I will say 200 back, way more painful. Easier to train, but God, it destroys you. You can't walk afterwards. The amount of, I have like 5 asthma attacks during that event. I banned myself. I hate it. It's terrifying. Whereas 200 fly, just, it hurts. But no, you can walk afterwards at least.
It's interesting to think, because the 200 fly, it's almost like, this is my very limited knowledge of swimming coming out here. So this is just kind of speculating, but also conversations I've had. But it seems like, and just thinking about what swimming teaches other skills, it's like the 200 fly or just learning the butterfly makes you appreciate rhythm. Because if you die at the end, it's also because your rhythm died. You know, it's like, well, what's fitness? It's like, well, it's a lot of things, but it's also like rhythm endurance. And can you not like fall? I would imagine that's a big piece of it, because I could just see if you get tired and you let your rhythm go apart. But then with the 200 back, Ryan Murphy, who won the gold in 2016, was telling me after he got back, he was like, that race, for some reason, he said his pecs were doing way more at the end than they ever had. It's almost like a thing where the stimulus of the Olympics cause every muscle to do that emotion that may not have been recruited before, but just the overarching thing is like, no, we're going to turn this on and this on just to get that going. It's just so cool to think about. And swimming almost like, it made me think like you could almost, there's more ways to compensate if you had to than like sprinting. Like,
yeah, for sure.
So just an interesting world.
And less ineffective, still ineffective, but less ineffective if you get it wrong, because it's obviously not as much force going through. Yeah, the rhythm thing's so fascinating. We've been talking with my new team in the women's side. We've been talking a lot about rhythm, and I actually have no idea if this is true. Who told me this story? I haven't validated it, but it's a great story, and it works well for all athletes I've been teaching sprinting, because so many team sport athletes, and I find this is even in athletics, but team sport in particular, when we say run fast, when we teach sprinting, it's just everything's so tight, everything's so switched on, everything's so aggressive and stiff that they don't relax. And swimming's the same. And I think that's where I got taught it, is trying too hard's just as ineffective as not trying hard enough. I remember doing a master's meet last year where I was so annoyed. I wasn't feeling great. I did a 50-free and it was terrible. I was so angry at myself. But I tried really hard during the race. And then I did a relay and I was really annoyed because they put me as first swimmer, and first swimmer's time gets put up on the board and it gets counted. It's like, I'm swimming terribly. I don't want people to see this awful time that I'm doing. But I relaxed in the race. So I was like, I care less. I'm just going to relax more, but I'm still going to try, but not try to the level I did in the individual. And I went half a second quicker on the same day over a 50, which is obscene. It just makes no sense. And it was kind of, hadn't done many races for quite some time. So it was a reinforcer back to me to try less hard, basically. Mm. But in a sprinting sense, I always tell the story that Japanese athletes were talent identified by putting electrodes on their face as kids to see who could relax their face when they ran. Again, I feel like maybe I got told it at uni, but have never corroborated the story. But I was chatting to one of my female athletes yesterday, and she was saying how that story really resonated with her. And she was doing some intervals of 30 on, 30 off on the weekend. And she wasn't going as well as she wanted to. So she went, okay, I'm going to try just focusing on the technique and relaxing. So just like relax my cheeks. And she went significantly further. It really resonated for her. And she's like, oh, okay, this is ridiculous, but it works. I have to relax. And even in drilling, I do better when I relax rather than tensing up and trying so hard. So it's a really fascinating one. And yeah, in swimming, when you try hard, it destroys you in an event in a 200. That's where you've just used too much energy too early. And then you lose position, you lose efficiency, you lose that rhythm. And then the piano falls and it's end game.
Yeah. Yeah. It is an interesting, like a medium of water and technique. I mean, technique's important in everything, but swimming is the one thing where I think a lot about like technique that a coach doesn't teach you. Like, hey, you're yes. feeling this the whole time. And if you just have to do like a 200 free or back or butterfly, you have to relax. Like it literally, or if you don't, yeah. you're going to get a pain teacher at the end. So it's like, it's not a coach even necessarily possibly, you know, I'm sure there's people who are too tight, but it's almost a thing where, and I think that the longer sprints and track can certainly teach you that too, but I almost think of the water as like a, yes. like an amplifier, you know, it's like a technical yeah. feedback amplifier. And it makes me think too, I mean, I ever since I left Cal and the swim programs there, like just even think about just water training in general. Like I watch like the Marinovich programs. They have just all sorts of like little, there's a video with like all these little, like almost like wrist and ankle, like straps with these little fins and people doing fast oh, yeah. oscillations in the water. I was like, that looks so cool. But yeah, with the oscillating stuff, it just makes me think too about having just a medium where you have that instant feedback. Like if you're doing, there's one thing to do oscillating on land or into a band and stuff. And I think that's all well and good, but to me, that just oscillating fast in the medium of water, it's like super speed, but then you get that little like feedback. It's like you're have that sensory. So it's just such a cool space to train. I love training in the water.
Absolutely.
So I
think people don't do it enough. And even like water running, a lot of people's natural choice when someone's injured is to put them on a bike. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's as effective as the water, either swimming or water running. Try and get them in the same positions as much as possible is always effective. It's one of the things we have a 25 meter pool, we have a shallow and a deep side at Collingwood, and it's super beneficial, and we do a lot of work in that in the men and women's. But I think swimming's the main thing you do, or water running's the main thing you do in the rehab space, so it's kind of nice to be somewhere that has similar philosophy on that.
Yeah. One last thing too, before I get to some of the high jump yeah. prep questions, there is pole vaulting. I was going to say, I feel like if there was one activity for physical prep or athletic performance coaches, I mean, I think like just learning the Olympic lifts is good from a movement yeah. perspective, but then to get beyond that, I mean, I think it's common. All right, we do Olympic lifts, we sprint, we do those types of things, but the pole vault combines so many things. You have to run, get inverted, there's gymnastic piece, there's an overcoming fear based piece, like you said, empathy for the bar and overcome. I just think that would be, if I was to pick one thing that I think all coaches, like general performance coaches, I mean, that's got to be the thing that has the most pieces, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think it's definitely up there. I mean, you could argue something like a high jump, but it doesn't have that strength element, that upper body gymnastics, I guess, element as much as the pole vault. I think it's such a cool event to learn. And it's funny because being a swimmer and a runner growing up, like no one really thinks that's cool because everyone mm-hmm. does it. At least where I grew up in Brisbane, everyone swims. It's just a thing. We had multiple Olympic gold medalists out of my age group in my state. Actually, not even my state, in my city. So, yeah, it's something everyone does. It's not really interesting and it's funny. And I am a terrible pole vaulter. Like, I'm not getting anywhere. Like, they jump three times me kind of level at the elite stage. But to see the buy-in and how people are so interested in, because I've been documenting my average journey through from when I started and sharing videos on it, how much more fascinated everyone is and how you learn it. And the most common thing people will say when I say I pole vault is like, oh, I couldn't do that. I couldn't even know where to start or how to learn it. But let's be honest, that's what coaches are for. But it's something that people can't even fathom going into. But yeah, it's such a great event, great sport, and you can do so many elements. Like, you've got to get a consistent run up. You need that rhythm. You need that speed. And sometimes, even myself, when I do a run up and I work my first year and a half, that's the main thing I worked on. If I try a little bit too hard, I lose my space and my balance and how I need to actually position my body. I can't just run hard like you would in 100 meters. You actually need more perspective, and you need that, you know, in a team sport, as you're coming in not to overrun, to tackle someone with the ball, or to come in and out of a space. You need to be aware of how to get your body in the right position. It's not just run 100% at them, because you'll get beat every single time. So there's a lot of cool translations from the sport. But yeah, I recommend everyone to try it. The person who kind of got me into it, I was interested already, but she told me she learned when she was 50, and it gave me a very good kick up the butt on there's no age to learn. And like, I've got no excuse learning in my 30s. Like, there's no reason we can't learn new things past the age of 25, which seems to be kind of the age that society recommends people to stop learning new sports or new activities and just stick with the things you're good at or that you do. So yeah, I love it. It's great.
Oh yeah. 100%. Yeah. I think too, like, especially like weight athletic performance, a lot of times it's like, I like lifting weights. And it's like, well, at some point, you know, like that skill tree can grow into a lot of different things. So I
100%. Like, I like running, I like movement, but it doesn't mean to be a good coach, we can't do other things or learn other things or make them good as well. We have to make our athletes can't just be good at their superpowers. They have to be good at other things as well. While we focus on our superpowers, we still need to upskill the other side to be a good coach.
Yeah. Yeah. Just kind of rounding out that GPP. Like, I find just being able to sit in all different realms of the GPP, it gives you that like intuitive sense of movement, and you can creatively apply it to the group in front of you. It's almost something that there's not always the exact formula for. I mean, in some ways, yes, but even just watching, so you had worked with Nicholas Lagers, you know, oceanic record holder in the high jump, and that training compilation you put with her was just amazing. Like, because it's like, it's gymnastics, it's like parkour plyometrics, like all this cool stuff. And so tell me a little bit about you two's journey together, coaching, working with her. Maybe start with some of the things that like, what are some of the focuses been on, and how have you incorporated some of those like more gymnastic-y, movement-oriented training methods into her program?
Yes, I've worked with Nick since it's either late 2016, early 2017. It's been a while. Neither of us remember the exact start date, but she came initially to where I was working at Sydney Uni. She was on scholarship there. And as part of our program there, we had elite athlete program, and she was part of that. So I was, I guess, her supervisor or her liaison in that space. And initially I was just there to kind of supervise and give her some technical advice. And then her coach, Matt, liked what I was doing. I got brought in to do a bit more, you know, prehab, core work, that side of things. Then I got brought in more to write her entire weaknesses program. And it just kept building and building from there. And it's quite funny. And I think a lot of strength and conditioning coaches go, we know more than athletics coaches. So I need to take the entire program without giving space to the athletics coach who has done it for many, many years and has been very successful. And they do know strength and conditioning. They may not say it in the same terms. They may not know everything that we know, but it doesn't mean they don't know things that we definitely don't know. So I think me not coming in with an ego to try and take over everything and change everything is the big space of building trust with the entire team. So I've been doing that for a very long time now with her, and I've always added elements of gymnastics in. She's a very tall athlete. She's 6'2", and her legs are the longest legs I've ever seen in my life. Her legs come up to like my shoulders. I always forget just how much shorter than I am to her till I see a photo, and I look like a child. I do forget that I'm as short as I am too, which doesn't help. But we've been doing a lot of work on her weaknesses. For her, that's often single leg strength stability and hinging, hip extension type worker and cross chain worker, her kind of key elements that have come across the whole way through that we're building and layering on every year. We've always done a little bit of elements of gymnastics, but we had a conversation after World Champs. So Nick got third at World Champs last year. The surface wasn't ideal for her, and that's okay, but the surface at the Olympics is also not most likely going to be the surface that she responds best to. She's more of a power jumper than a speed jumper, and her main competition are more speed jumpers, and the track's being more and more focused around how do we make the 100-meter runners faster. So it focuses really well to those speed jumpers. So we went, all right, we need to do something slightly different. It doesn't mean we've taken out strength work. That's probably the key that people will be like, oh, you can't just throw that out. We're not. She's always still doing her strength work. She's a very strong girl. She just missed 85 the other week, but 82.5 for clean when you're 60-odd kilos is legit, pretty impressive power to weight. So she's still doing all of that, but we went, all right, let's try something different and let's go into a gymnastics facility. And we'd talk bits around this for a while, but it was probably the first time we've really bitten the bullet and gone, yeah, let's give it a crack. And it was over the off season. It was the first program. She came back coming out of off season of complete break. So a couple of the thinking around that is, all right, one, for her, something that I've always thought of is when she comes over the bar, she tucks her feet underneath. And often as she fully gets over, she kind of drops her hips slightly as she comes down towards the mat. And if she hits it, she'll hit it with one ankle just as she's coming over. So, all right, what movement and how can we get her to the point where she can get her legs coming up and over quicker so she's not hitting that bar? And we actually had this conversation last week with Nicola about the fact that she'd just trained with Blanca over in Croatia for a session, and Blanco is explaining about the fact that you actually can't think while you're in the air. There's not enough time. There's no ability to go, oh, okay, I'm now in the air. I'm going to move my foot in this position. It's just not really something that's overly possible. You have to train it in different ways so it becomes automatic when you're in that position rather than trying to fix it in that position in the air. So for me, the movement that was really going to transfer is that backflip, being able to get your legs up and over and that improving your center of mass in the air. So I started, I went, all right, so how do I get the elements that I really want from a gym perspective in the gymnastics facility? What areas can we improve because we've got things like a trampoline and a sprung floor? And for Nick, she's a very mentally strong, very good psychological athlete. If she's able to do something before, so I think I'm going to probably butcher the quote, but she mentioned at indoors when she won, she'd done 199 on a very cold, and it was very cold. I was in multiple jumpers. Very cold night in Melbourne. The track was very cold, very hard, wasn't giving her much recoil, and she was still able to jump 199 there. If she could do it there, she could do it in world indoors where she'd tapered, where the track was bouncy. So it was more the mental aspect for her getting over rather than, like, physically she can do it. We know this, but it was the mental aspect on that third attempt, being able to jump over that bar. So trying to put elements that will challenge her mentally do tend to translate as well. So I started out on first program layering different sides. So one was coordination, so different extensive plyos that are going to challenge her on different surfaces as well. So she mentioned at World Outdoors last year that it was quite soft and she didn't feel like she could hold her position in those last two steps before she jumped over the bar, which are the most important steps. So we went, all right, you need to be able to be comfortable landing on any surface, being able to hold positions, be stiff, strong, etc. So we added in a bit of an obstacle course where she'd land on different soft, hard, big surfaces. And I told her to be creative, and she's a creative person. And went, all right, just chuck a bunch of things down on the ground, make it fun, make it challenging, but make sure you are landing on different surfaces, hard and soft. So we did that as an obstacle course. And you could see over the, I think we did it for maybe 8 weeks, maybe just longer, you could see the difference between the start and the end on her confidence and her strength and ability to land on those surfaces in a good position and not collapse. We laid on different elements of single leg strength and stability, which didn't leave her program. It was just done in different ways without a barbell. And how do I overcome and manipulate body weight to make it just as challenging as I would with a barbell, and keeping some of that range of motion strength. So we often go back to deeper ranges in the off season. Well, I do, sorry. So Matt can focus on the main stuff he needs to without having to do a lot of deep work. So we went back to single leg thing, like towards pistols and things like that, where she's getting a lot of range, strength through range. So again, no matter what position she finds herself in, she'll be able to get out of it, rather than just, this is the ideal position, we'll train that and make her strong in that. It's okay, let's ensure anything that's thrown at her, she'll be able to handle and handle as efficiently as possible. So a lot of that work, she is not upper body strong. She has very small arms. It is not a strength of hers. However, she's not weak. She may have been 5-10 years ago, but she's not weak anymore in those arms. But it is a key element for her, and what she calls the BAM, is throwing that arm up as she goes over the bar. That's a really key movement pattern for her, and she finds when she's stronger in her arms that that's beneficial to her. So working out ways to do some upper body work, again, without weights, that was going to ensure that she is going to be able to do that movement the best possible. And we did a lot of handstand and rope work. So initially it was, all right, you've got a rope, climb as high as you can the first 4 weeks, see if we can get to the top on the last week. And that also gave her a fun challenge. It made it exciting. It made it different. It's more interesting than, you know, just go do some chin-ups. So she's been an elite athlete for a long time now. This is not just physically beneficial, but it's mentally beneficial for her. And it's not variety for variety's sake either, which is something I was really cognizant of when I was programming. I'm like, not just programming for fun, or this will be fun, but every single thing has a key element. So it's like single leg strength, power, arch over the bar, her core, basically different areas that need to be overcome. How do I get what I want out of it? And then we went from doing rope climb to rope chin-ups, so one hand over the other, pulling up. We did that on both sides, and then we moved towards straddle rope climbs, which I think is one of the hardest but fun challenges for someone who's not done gymnastics, because you don't really think how much your core, your quads, your body is involved in getting yourself up when you're in that position using just your arms to climb. So that was a really good one, and I expected it to be quite challenging at the start. Like, I think Nick's got 4 or 5 chin-ups is the most we've actually gone to in a block. So it's not like she's repping out your pole vaulters who can do 50 kilos for a rep and 20 chin-ups every day. That's not her strength. So her getting to the point of being able to do a straddle and do climbs, I think she got 5 or 6 basically steps with her hands. That was really, really impressive, and showed how much strength she had gained. But the key one that I think made the biggest difference was the backflip. So I looked back and I chatted past next door neighbor of mine was a level 10 gymnast. So I always chat to her about it. She also transitioned to athletics, so she's a fantastic one to liaise with. And I talked to her about different ways of doing it. I went, all right, first step for me is being able to do a backwards roll. So we used the wedge, getting comfortable with doing a backwards roll, being able to do it and try and stand up strong. That was the first level, nice low level. Then we went to basically move to work on like a backwards flat back, where you jump and you land flat on your back, and then she would pull her legs over. Different methods of that before layering on backflips into a foam pit. So things that were safe, that I wasn't going to break her. I wasn't going day one, yeah, let's just backflip. She wasn't ready for that. So we went and did work. I think it took us 12 to 16 weeks before she could land on her feet. And she got confident jumping and landing onto the mats. But often, because she could do the motion previously, but she'd land on her knees, so getting confidence to land it on her feet. But first comp of the year was coming up in Canberra. It's her favourite surface. Went, this is going to be a great challenge to see this gymnastics play out. Everything else has been very similar to previous years. What's this done? Has it been beneficial? Do we need to throw it out? What's worked? What hasn't? And she rocked up to Canberra. She didn't miss a height until she got to 203, which was her PB. And she equaled her PB in her opener of the year, which is almost unheard of. It was phenomenal. And for me, watching her position over the bar, it never looked like her feet were curling under. It didn't look like she was going to touch. So that was a really good indicator that the movement we'd been training was actually transferring across to the high jump. It wasn't, it was a very obvious picture comparison between her previous jumps. So because we were going up to World Indoors, we went, all right, let's go back and see if our traditional model of doing things, still keeping a bit of gymnastics, but our traditional model will help. We don't really have access to a gymnastics facility over the next 4 or 5 weeks coming into World Indoors. Let's go backwards. And we went back to our traditional way of doing things. And it actually, you could see the position wasn't there. And immediately after the competition, it was, yeah, we're going back to gymnastics. So fascinating kind of way. We just threw it in as, I think this will work. It makes sense. The movements make sense. But yeah, the translation and transfer into high jump was greater than we even expected.
Yeah. It's what was, just to contrast that, you mentioned like the traditional way, I'm assuming that's just more like basic regular sets and reps of things in the gym. Would that be just kind of typical gym work?
yeah, typical gym work, focusing on those key weaknesses, those single leg strength, the hinging. We still added a little bit of work that we did in the facility, but no extensive jumping, no backflipping, all of the work that you have to do kind of in a gymnastics facility, we had to cut.
Yeah. Did you, when you went back to the gymnastic work, did you bring back in that extensive, I like call it parkour jumps, because in the video, it's like all sorts of different, like, it's not just almost, it seems like it's not just like a straight line, different surfaces, it's like side to side, high, low, and it's like a very rich environment to jump in, which I think high jumpers would love. Like, I mean, I love doing that type of stuff. So, like, did you get back to that, or what were the, you got back to that type of work as well, or, and less weights, or how did things kind of swing back there?
Yeah, so we've literally just started as of last Wednesday, the new block. And yes, we've gone back to extensive, a little bit of tumble track work, a little bit of aggressive. So I actually don't have a great name for these, but really fast single leg jumps on the trampoline, trying to almost overcome being double bounced and being able to hold your hip position. We've done different jumps with bands, jumping forward and back. So using body weight, using bands to manipulate how I would use if I did have weights. So being able to do that, but being able to do that on a surface that's not so aggressive that it will fatigue her then when she goes and does her jump sessions. So I've always been really aware not to do too much jumping in the gym, because it does actually fatigue her, and my sessions partly like it's fatiguing, but it's a little bit more regeneration. So making sure that when she goes for her jump sessions, we've not cooked her. So the sprung flooring, the trampoline, has been an enormous benefit, because we can add more in without absolutely destroying her. She doesn't feel as fatigued as she would if we did this kind of work on a normal floor, a gym flooring or cement or even grass. So yeah, highly encourage people to use sprung flooring, even just the gymnastic matting.
Yeah, the mats.
Trampolines. It's just so much better to be able to overload these areas without it being a problem later on and having the coach come at you going, you've done too much, you've cooked them.
Yeah, one of my favorite plyometric surfaces of all time. I'm not sure if it's the same as a gymnastic mat, but like a wrestling mat. I'm sure it's very similar. But
yeah,
it's just like
yeah.
You know, like 1.5 inch thick foam or something like that. It just feels so good, especially barefoot stuff, because it still gives you spring. It's not like it doesn't give spring for you, but it lets you feel that contact in just this subtly different way that just feels so good. So I'm a huge fan. Like I mean, I don't have a wrestling room near me, but if I did, I would definitely make plenty of use of it.
Yeah, I think the other thing you just mentioned, on these types of flooring, you're not in shoes, you're barefoot.
Yeah.
Which, and Nick's been lucky to grow up, live and train on the Central Coast, which is one of the most beautiful areas, but she's got a beach right near her, and her initial training, no matter when she comes back, will always start on sand and grass rather than going straight on track, which isn't uncommon, but the sand, she's always done blocks of sand her entire life. So being able to have that intrinsic foot strength, I think, has been a big benefit into keeping her injury free. And she's probably one of the, or I would say she's one of, if not the least injured in any of the disciplines in athletics. Like, she's had 2 injuries her entire career. And one was because she did long jump, at a uni nationals. So she's been able to maintain her consistency and her training because she's not getting injured. She's not taking this time out, having to come back up. She's able to continue every year getting better because she's not had these kind of setbacks through injury.
Today's podcast is sponsored by the Plyomat. The Plyomat is not only an incredible vertical jump and reactive strength index testing device, but it also is an incredible training device. The Plyomat not only allows single response jumps, but also the chaining of multiple mats together. So you can use it for bounding, multiple series of hurdle hops. You can get not only height, but reactive strength for a multi-jump situation. It's an incredible, again, testing and training tool, and you can learn more at pliomat.net. On the level of supplements, Lost Empire Herbs has been my go-to for the last 5 years. As someone who is constantly observing nature in motion to help me understand movement better, so too do I draw from nature in my supplementation regime. If you want to check out some of my favorite supplements for energy, strength, and enhancing the total impact of your training regimen, things such as Shilajit, which has been well recommended by many strength coaches, the Phoenix Formula, which was my original Lost Empire Herb supplement that really made me a believer in the power of herbalism, things like pine pollen, mushroom tinctures, and more, you can head to lostempireherbs.com/justfly. There you can use the code JOEL15, that's JOEL15, for 15% off your order. Definitely check out Lost Empire Herbs. They're an awesome company and will really help that total aspect of your performance training process. Yeah, it's interesting. I've heard, at least I think, I'm trying to remember, like at least some debate about sand training. Oh, is it too much like give, you know, and this or that or the other thing. But I think at the end of the day, each surface has its own thing to offer. It has its own gift to offer in a way.
Yeah.
And like you mentioned, I was actually thinking of a podcast with Romain Tullion recently where he talked about when the toes flex upwards, when the toes dorsiflex, that like loads the foot differently than if they're down. Yeah. And compared to wearing shoes on flat ground, yes, the toes are going to flex, but like sand, you really get it. And I remember it was my father-in-law actually had mentioned like he had plantar fasciitis for the longest time. And the only thing that got it to go away actually was walking in the sand, like just on the beach,
yeah.
No training at all or whatever. And so it's like when you have that, like it's almost like you think about like what a full range squat gives you, like from just a basic muscle balance and muscle length and those things. It's like, hey, full range work for the feet. Maybe there's different ground contact times or whatever. And I also feel like too, there's also something I think that's fundamentally different. I think having, if you have a patch of sand, like a runway of sand, a sand pit, that's cool. But like, there's also something about being on the beach. Like that's just an X factor. Yeah. You can't, you know, whatever the salt water, you get like the good ions from the sand and the water, whatever it is, you know, there's something about that I think is powerful. So another thing that'd be good to have around here, but I don't. So
hopefully one day beach nice and close to you. But yeah, I agree. And I think I completely understand the argument that people have, but I think it's almost a little reductive. It's the same as people arguing, don't use machine weights or don't do this, don't do that. It's the context. And her doing a block for 3-4 weeks as she comes off no training, yeah, we actually don't want the ground contact time to be as good. We want her to be able to reload slower. We want those feet to gain the strength back that they'd lost. It's, yeah, and it's not like she's doing actual high jump on the beach. It's rudimentals.
Yeah.
It's plyometric stuff. It's running. It's jumping. But it's not all her training and it's not all the time. So, yeah, I think as strength and conditioning coaches, we can be quite reductive in our arguments and focus in on this or that rather than looking at, yeah, if we go like that, no one's going to put gymnastics in for her training because, God forbid, we take out some of the weights. So it's working out what works best for that person. And it does, again, two injuries. And, I mean, her biggest injury was this 15 centimeter soleus tear that she got in the openers of Com Games. Now, we MRI'd it before we cleared her to jump post-injury, but she returned from that to jump at Diamond League in 3 weeks. Like, that's unheard of. And I think partly that's her mentality and how she believes that she will heal, because she will. And placebo or not, she is a great healer, but 3 weeks is unbelievable. And I think that shows the work she's done. It's long-term athlete development that her coach Matt has taken her on since she was a child, and she just responds so well. So yeah, I think keeping the context and not making a this or that kind of argument as coaches is important.
Yeah, I think it's a very like one and zero thinking, you know, versus a more comprehensive or complex, like, and training isn't like a machine, you know, it's this interconnection of all these different, you know, moving parts. And so, yeah, plus two, if you make your main sport is jumping really high on a track surface repeatedly, like, yeah, give your feet a break, you know? I always felt like too, jumping, when I've done, like, I remember one summer in my college track and field years, just messing around at a summer trip to Michigan. And like, there's almost like, if you're at the lake, there's that actually sweet spot at the sand, I feel like, where you have like the powdery stuff, which you can't really jump on. Well, you can do it, but I find like you get the sand that's like what the waves go over, but it's not like in the water. That's like the best. Like if you get a little push off. So you kind of get to find the sweet spot, which is also part of it. I was going to say, you mentioned giving her some creativity and autonomy, like for like the plyometrics, would you have her like, hey, put like targets out, or how did that work with that interaction?
Yeah. So Nick is a very autonomous athlete. She is an absolute student of her sport. If anyone's watched her interaction over the years with her coach, it's almost to the point of they've both got this ownership. Matt will tell her something. She will give him information back. It's not a dictatorship. It's not a one's higher than the other. They have a open conversation on what's best. And even in competition now, he'll give her he will visually show her something versus having, oh, you need to do this, this, this. So I think that's also part of working together for, gosh, it's got to be over 15 years now, I reckon, for those two. It's a long time. So she is very aware of what she needs to do, how she needs to do it. Telling her like she doesn't is not treating her fairly or meeting her where she's at in her development. So giving her autonomy in a way that doesn't stress her out, make her tired, give her extra mental load is where I put it in. So yeah, obstacle course, okay, your key thing. So in this next block, it's I want to focus a bit on her stiffness position. Like, all right, you can add max 2 cycles in that circuit, but I want you landing on surfaces in a stiff position, and then you can add the big cylinder and jump over that, but put it in any position you like. Remember, you run in a arch position. You aren't running in a straight line like you are in most other sports in athletics. Like, it is a straight, it's not a straight line. So don't do it in a straight line. Mix it up. Every now and then I'll be like, maybe do it in a circle next week. See how that feels. So just adding different constraints to let her be as creative and work out what she needs as well. So I'm not a high jumper. I don't think I jumped higher than 110 in my entire life. I'm the world's worst. I have such short legs and I'm terrible. The reason I like pole vault is I try and make the pole do the work. Technically, I shouldn't do that, but we do what we can. Yeah. but she knows the position she needs to feel. She's fully aware of it. So as long as I give her the constraints around what I want out of it, what she should try and feel herself, she's allowed to be as creative as she wants and make a cool circuit for herself and feel what she needs to feel, but also get the quality that I need trained out as well.
Yeah, that I think that that working with the athlete, the autonomy, I mean, it's one, it's so critical, but it also makes me think back when I was working with swim Olympians, and we just talked about my swimming. Like, I covered 25 butterfly and was like, yes, this is amazing. Like, you know, my swimming was not great. And here's all these incredible swimmers. And, you know, the gym is not the water, but at the same time, they also had like little exercises that they felt they felt things that they felt in the water. And I think, if I could have done one thing a little better, I think I could have really dug into that more 5 years ago. I could have taken what they were finding a little bit further. And sometimes it was funny because it was things that I guess more of a mainline, you say, oh, you can't replicate that in the weight room or whatever. Yeah. Well, if they're feeling it, like you and it's an Olympian, and swimmers are so good at feeling things. Like they are good because yes, they're built for it in many ways, but they're also obsessive with details and technique and the medium of the water. And I wish I would have spent a little bit more time on that when I had that. I mean, I learned a ton from them for sure, but I think I could have spent more time just going into some of those pieces. But, you know, I love that. Plyometric courses, it makes me think, too, as you're talking, I've thought this, this has kind of come up in my head a lot recently, but I remember Michael Zweifel, when he was on the podcast a while ago, recommending that everyone train kids and pros on some level.
Yes.
And because everything, those are the two poles, and all training kind of swings back and forth between, you could say training kids is like obstacle courses, gymnastics, climbing ropes, you know, monkey bars.
Yeah.
And then taking that all the way up in intensity, but it doesn't stay all the way pro, you know, or regimented, whatever that means, right? We think about it, it's all just numbers and here's your volume and, you know, here's X, Y. It's like, well, no, like we could come back and do some like more complex gymnastic-y stuff that you probably couldn't, you know, necessarily like put a force meter on, but it's just fun. It's like complex coordination. And so it's like cool to see. You, it's like, hey, you know, you needed to go back to some of, I guess you could call it like just play in a way, but you know, the dial back a little bit, you know, turning that dial back into more of the fun coordinative things versus just all pure regimented traditional. But not that it's traditional is obviously needed at some point too. It's just kind of finding that sweet spot for each athlete.
100%. And like, let's be honest, no athlete goes into their sport as a child and goes, I just want to be here to make money. Mm-hmm. Every single athlete goes in, this is fun. So yes, it's a job to us. It's a job to them. And it doesn't take away from the seriousness of what they're doing. But at the end of the day, they did this because it's fun. And I think where I absolutely love watching Nick over any other athlete, and obviously biased, but she has fun. You can see the joy. Mm-hmm. And it's not put on. That's just her nature. She loves it. She absolutely loves it. And it's quite funny watching indoors. I find her and Hamish Curran, they've trained together many times. They're good mates, but I find them quite similar in how they approach and how they look when they jump. They just look like they're having fun. And if you look like you're having fun, one, your competitors who aren't, start going, oh crap, why are they so joyful? Like, what's wrong? And they start internalizing. So it's actually a form of psyching out without trying to. And they just get in their head versus someone who's letting it be and having fun with it. It just means the longevity in the sport, the joy, and it means you can take those losses, those bad performances, and not keep them with you and use them. Well, unfortunately, they end up being used against you in the wrong moments. So, like Nick's first ever international open Australian team was 2017 world champs. She no height it. She came dead last. That's so easy to then next jump, have that in your brain, go, well, I no heighted last time. What makes me, what am I going to do this time? So being able to have joy with it, realizing that while it is a job, why I want to do the best possible, I want to do something that's never been done. At the end of the day, it is just a sport. It's just a game. It's just a jump. It's not the reason someone's going to live or die. But if I have fun with it, it's going to be enjoyable. And at the end of the day, I'm going to have an amazing experience. I think having that mindset is so helpful. And sport turning from amateur to pro has challenged a lot of athletes in all different sports, because all of a sudden when you're getting paid, it's, oh, well, this is a job. I have to think in a certain way. I have to make it serious. But it's a form of entertainment. It's joy. It's fun. It's how do I do something and show other people that we can do something that's never been done. It's not surgery. It's not saving someone's life. Let's have fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me, I believe it was Pele, the soccer player. I think one of his pregame visualizations was like visualizing when he was like six and just playing, like, you know, just the most, like, just when things were the most fun, and like going back to that, those just joyful childhood memories of play. And yeah, it's almost like the same spectrum, and with movement too. Like those movements that say, hey, this is how much fun. I mean, a backflip. How much fun is a backflip? Like, seriously. Like, and it is funny. I mean, I saw like in the video, yes, there's foam pits and there's a progression, but it's interesting to think about. I mean, even if there was no transfer, which obviously there was, but even if there was no transfer in something, well, this is just fun. And of course you do want to, like, yeah. You know, I mean, like you said, those at the beginning, these aren't just fun. They have a specific purpose. I think we all know the training for entertainment. Hey, stand on a balance ball and do X, Y, Z, and it's as interesting, and activate the salience network. But if it's fun and it's relevant, that's like, just the art to finding that for the athlete. I think that it all kind of runs together in a way. And yeah, you're totally right. When I've watched her jump, you know, she's just smiling, and it makes me think about, I think it was Stanford researcher Kelly McGonigal. I think she's Stanford, but like there's different emotions associated with different movements. Like strength is associated with confidence, and jumping is, you know, jump for joy. It's associated with joyfulness.
Yeah.
Which is so cool. There's definitely that emotional connection. Yeah.
Yeah. And if it can bring some joy to people, if it makes them happy watching her, I remember it was States or Nationals in Sydney in like 2018 or 19. It was a long time ago, watching Nick jump. And in domestically, this is quite common. She starts after everyone else has finished. And she had started her jumps, and all the others stayed around watching. And Nick missed a height, and she comes bounding over to Matt and I. She's like, oh, I loved everything about that jump, but I just did this wrong and I missed. That's okay. I'm like, all happy. And you'd watch these young jumpers who had just so stressed and tried so hard and like getting all angry and slamming things down, and don't get me wrong, I'm no better. I get frustrated when I jump badly when I pole vault. But her role modeling a way to act when you fail, when you don't get it, is so beneficial to athletics, the society we live in. You go, it's okay to miss. We've got other, like, we go again, we try, we challenge different things. So, yeah, I think she's just such a great role model in that space, to help young athletes realize that it's not the end of the world if we don't get what we want that day. Hell, she hadn't won a national title in any age group. And yeah, Eleanor's in her age group, so it doesn't help. But there were times she came third or fourth all through her juniors. She hadn't won a national since till like 2018. It's not, we have to win now. She had a long-term vision. Matt had a long-term vision for her, and they stuck to it. So having the end goal and realizing that short-term success doesn't necessarily mean long-term success. All those kind of lessons that they've taught me, that they've taught me about long-term athlete development, have really helped how I view different training. And it's cool having the lens of swimming, because swimming is such a short-term, early specialization sport. People are winning Olympic medals at 13, 14. So it is, you have to win. You have to win early. You have to do this fast. So being able to take a step back and see it done so well has been such a joy to be a part of as well.
Yeah, that's something that I was just having a conversation with Liz Gleedle, is a Canadian javelin thrower, and she was talking about every day as a gift, like seeing every session as a gift. And then I think a day or two after, I was reading Rick Rubin's book on creativity, and it was talking about how you're only going to have today once, and it will teach you something that no other day will. I was like, that is so cool. Like, if we could have that like attitude, then it does really become something that's so special. And I think there's obviously on the part of Nick, there's so much maturity in that too. But I mean, yeah, I've been there on the frustrated, like I've thrown the high jump bar back in the day and
javelin throw it down the field.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's where my javelin throw actually started. I was doing that before I started, and then I started throwing my junior year. So, but hey, I'd love to close out with talking a little bit about. So you mentioned the single leg strength. I just thought that was intriguing. And I saw in the video, it reminded me a little bit of like Werner Gunther back in the day. The videos everyone loves in his first phase. It's right, because people don't show this one as much. They show like the main complex training
the stair
pieces.
Jumps. And oh the yeah, hurdles.
Oh, like the big, like, you know, like stuff, which is obviously awesome. But the stuff that some of those little nuanced things I think are so cool too, like all the subtle things, like you're talking about, it's like the little weaknesses, the little subtleties. And I think those are every bit as important, especially with a elite athlete who needs to shore up any possibility. But he was doing like shot put on like balance, like gymnastics balance beams. He was doing his glide and landing on a gymnastics beam type thing. Like the 300-pound guy doing this like balance stuff. But I saw, I think she was doing like single leg squats with something like that. I was just curious because I just think that something I have thought about recently as well is like, how do you overload something? We oftentimes, let's just put more weight on the bar. Well, it's like, well, I don't know, if you have less surface area of the foot, you're overloading stuff on the foot and the balance, you know? So like, tell me a little bit more about that and then the single leg training. And you mentioned her as a single leg need. So I'd be curious to hear more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So she probably hates me saying this, but she was a baby giraffe. She was not a hugely coordinated athlete in certain planes, certain areas. She is in other areas. She's no motor moron. She picks skills up very quickly. But single leg is very challenging, being able to do a single leg squat. And one thing that she probably hadn't been exposed to as much growing up was more training at depth. A lot of it was at quarter depth because that's the transfer in athletics. But I think she needed to be strong through the entire chain. So, and that's something I found out while working with her, that she just had no ability to stabilize or be strong in those positions. And it may not have directly transferred into performance, but what it will do is actually decrease her risk of injury, because she doesn't just high jump her entire 24/7. She moves. So how can we make sure? And that's, again, probably something I learned from swimmers, and I'm putting myself in this group big time. We tend to injure ourselves, not necessarily in the pool, but like, you know, walking, tripping over something, you know, just doing random stuff that is nothing to do with swimming. That's where we get hurt, because we're uncoordinated, and that's why we're in the pool. So making sure that she didn't do any of that side as well. But she said from World Outdoors that she felt like she couldn't stabilize. She felt like she couldn't balance when she was on that surface. And it felt really hard to be able to jump from that. So she wanted to actually have better stability, better single leg strength as well, which is good, because that was what I saw as well. So doing, and it's basic. It's not something that is outside of the realm. It's what you go back to in that LTAD and in general prep. Single leg squat from a box, single leg squat to a box, single leg squat, holding a band, the depth. None of that's interesting, special, or different to anyone else. But we sometimes forget about going back to that level when we've got a really high level athlete.
Yeah.
And just because they're world champion, just because they're an Olympic medalist, doesn't mean they don't have gaps. And credit to Nick, anytime I find a weakness of hers, she gets very excited, because it means that there's more room for her to get better, which is not a mindset that most people take, including, yeah, majority of athletes don't like hearing that they've got another weakness. They feel almost that's a judgment, whereas she takes it as such an opportunity. And we went back and went, all right, let's work on this single leg strength. Let's work on the stability. So any surface that you end up on, any jump that you're, any position you end up in, because let's be honest, if you stuff up your run up going into a high jump and you're in a lower position, if you're in a slightly rotated position than what you're used to, let's make sure that you can still jump well out of that position, have a decent crack. Because a lot of people, second last step, if your second last step in high jump is poor, half of them just give up. They just don't even attempt that high. And you just give every chance to yourself to have that opportunity to get over, even if it's not perfect, is kind of my philosophy around what I do with her. And yeah, she's just never been super strong in those areas. I've got a lot of videos where she'll single leg squat and her hips will drop out. She can't hold those positions she needs to. So if we're adding extra speed, that's increased force. She's got to be able to hold her hips in the right position in those last couple of steps to ensure she can get the best jump possible. So yeah, single leg squats into curtsy squats, all of that kind of work has slowly built up, and we've been doing it over the years, like, you know, with barbell two up, one down kind of work, building to, yeah, barbell single leg squats to the rack and all of that kind of type of training. But I do find that body weight is also just allowing her to focus on her. Sometimes when it's a bar, she's so used to trying to lift it fast and do the right things from that perspective, she forgets the key elements that she needs in that single leg area, which is that hip position, not dropping your hip out, keeping actually, you know, knee going in the correct plane. It's not things that she's been great. Like when I first started with her, she had a lot of issues with valgus in a lot of different movements. So that's pretty much gone from her movement now. She can hold those positions, and now it's more let's focus on that hip when she does those single leg movements and making sure that, yeah, she can hold the correct position that she needs to under force, under different elements. So we've been adding bands in different positions for her to challenge it. Nothing special, but really impactful for her.
Yeah. The single leg squats, there's certainly, I mean, if you get too crazy with it, it loses effectiveness at some point, for sure. I really like the curtsy variations. Cliff Hartsky puts a lot of cool ones on his social media, and I always am inspired by those. Well, just closing things out here, because I know we're kind of running out of time, but so you said you're just getting back into that training block with Nick. Is there anything coming up, any competitions or anything exciting on the horizon then that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, she has nationals coming up in April, which would be great, but I think we'll end up training through that, given that she's already hit the automatic qualifier for the Olympics a bunch of times and world champion. So I don't think they're going to not select her. So it allows us to get a big training block through to about May when she leaves for Europe and goes over to start the Diamond League season before the Olympics. So as much training block as possible to try and get her in the best space. And then we've already worked out how we can keep doing gymnastics overseas, finding nice little facilities for her to continue this star work, because it has been more impactful to her than what we have done previously. So trying to keep it into the Olympics has been something we discussed last week to ensure that, yeah, we're able to do the best jump possible and try and give her the best opportunity to not only win, but her ultimate goal of jumping 210. So whatever we can do to try and get her to reach those heights is what we'll try and do as a team. And we're very lucky. It's a small team. We work very well together. And there's a lot of, yeah, open conversation and lack of ego in that space to allow us to feed and collaborate off each other, which is great. I love it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, yeah, 210, I mean, I think that's just 1 centimeter over the world record, right? So,
yep.
So cool. Awesome. So cool. Well, hey, Nick, thank you so much for coming back on the show. It was wonderful chatting with you today. And I got a lot of great things to think about moving forward. So I really appreciate your time.
No, always. And love what you do in the podcast, and always love chatting to you. I learn a lot as well. Thanks for having me, Joel.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the show. I'll see you next week.